You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Nitzana Darshan-Leitner, who's an Israeli activist and attorney. As a founder and director of the Israel Law Center, Sharat HaDin, based outside Tel Aviv, she has represented hundreds of terror victims in lawsuits worldwide. She's also the author of the new book, Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
Thank you, Vince, for inviting me. It's so exciting to be in the Spy Museum.
We appreciate you taking the time. I want to ask about this book because it just came out, and it's a book that would have been difficult to try to write before now, because a lot of what's in it, a lot of the story had been secret until relatively recently. Can you talk a little bit about how the process to declassifying some of this and why it took so long to do?
Right. So first of all, just a little bit background about myself. Mm-hmm. I'm the president of Sharat HaDin Israel Law Center. This is a civil rights organization based in Israel that fights terrorism in courtrooms. We simply file lawsuits against terror organizations and their financial patrons. And in the course of our work, we were working with the unit in the Mossad that tracks terror financing. We've been working with them for 15 years, and we were familiar with the operations that they did because some of them involved us. So when we wanted to write the book, we had the knowledge. We just needed to clear it up.
Right.
And that was a process. We had to go through the censorship in Israel. And as a permission to publish the book, quite frankly, we were very doubtful that the censor will let us publish this book. But surprisingly, they agreed. Not only agreed, they worked with us to go through it. And they had to clear it up with the Mossad and the Shin Bet and the intelligence in the IDF and all the security services there. And everybody had his own comments,
right.
And everybody had
his own
stuff.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners will be very familiar with how the process works in the United States, where if you're writing about or have been involved with any of the agencies, you've got to go to each individual agency. And you're
Precisely.
Dealing here with, I think the misperception, again, we have a very educated audience, but even some may not know that there are multiple intelligence agencies inside
of
Israel.
Of course,
The Mossad gets all the news, but they're not all doing all the work, especially in this case.
Well, yes. Yeah. So the Mossad is equal to the CIA here, and the Shin Bet is equal to the FBI. And then you have the military intelligence, and then you have the National Security Agency. You have quite a bit to go through. But since it is a pro-Israeli book and has a strong message of for other Western countries how to fight terrorism in a new, provocative way, innovative way, the censor agreed to publish the book.
Yeah, as I was reading through it, I'm like counting the different agencies that were mentioned, and I'm like, oh, this shouldn't be bad. It's only a couple, and then there's like one sentence with Unit 8200. I'm like, oh, there's another one that you've got to deal with. Because again, in the United States, if you just mention somebody, you've got to go through that process and get them to sign off on it. So for a lot of our listeners that don't know some of the history, really at the height of terrorist attacks across several decades, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, there were very few people in Israel at the highest level, certainly within the IDF or within the intelligence community, thinking that money was kind of a key issue for fighting terrorism. But at the same time, there were serious problems. I mean, the history of this time is just suicide bombing after suicide bombing after suicide bombing. And I'm not going to use the word heavy-handed, but the military options to prevent this didn't seem to be working very well.
Right, right. Terrorism in Israel did not start in the first intifada. It was always there. But after the Oslo Accords were signed with the PLO and Israel, and they created the Palestinian Authority, we were supposed to get some peace,
right,
some arrangement that now the Palestinians will have their own authority, and let's see from there how they go. But instead, we got wave of terrorism. We got suicide bombing. We got missile attacks. We got stabbings in the streets. We got drive-by shootings and ambushes, and people were getting killed on a daily basis. And then you're really getting very frustrated, because how do you fight that organization that are inside you?
Right.
I mean, you gave over some land to the Palestinian Authority to take over and to control, but the majority is still under your control, and it was almost impossible. The terrorists living among you. So the idea came, and it was initiated by Meir Dagan, the former head of the Mossad, to try to go after the infrastructure of the terror organizations, because if you cannot pinpoint them one by one, perhaps you can just demolish their infrastructure.
And at the time, tens of millions of dollars is going into organizations like Hamas and the PLO and Hezbollah in Lebanon and others. And this is money for operations, money for training, money for even things like paying the widows of suicide bombers. I think you even mentioned in the book, and I think the perception is that suicide bombing is kind of the cheap man's terrorism, where it's, $150 worth of nails and rat poison and ball bearings and send somebody in to blow themselves up. But this is a huge operation that costs tens of thousands of dollars just to send one guy into a cafe
Absolutely,
somewhere.
Absolutely. It's a whole organization from top to bottom. You have the soldiers in the ground, the one that were, I would say, suckered to go and carry out the suicide bombing. But then you have the handlers, and you have those who pay them, and you have those who command them, and there are units. Every area in the West Bank and Gaza has its own commander, has units, and they're all getting paid. All the militants, all the combatants, all the terrorists are getting paid with the organization. The population itself is getting paid, not paid cash, but they get provided with all services they need from cradle to grave for free in order to give loyalty to the terror organizations. In the end, the terror organizations are working and operating among civilians, among population, and the only way this population will let them operate among them is by paying them money.
And a lot of this money is coming from Iran, but also some money is coming from the United States and from Western Europe and charities or NGOs.
Yes.
And I wanted to put quotes around the word charities, but they are, in some respects, some of the money is, but very little of the money is funneling to the actual people on the ground who need money. A lot of it's going, was going directly in the pockets of...
Unfortunately. Both the charities around the United States and Europe, we all know the names like the Holy Land Foundation and Interpol in England and CBSP in France were raising millions of dollars for Hamas, and the money was supposed to go to the population to build schools and build hospitals But the majority of the money were diverted to terrorism. Hamas were just controlling the money and were using it to for the bombs, for the missiles, for the explosives. Same way the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority, in the end of the day, was controlled by Yasser Arafat, who was the head of the PLO, which is a designated terror organization. And he was receiving support from the European Union and from the United States. You know, the Palestinian Authority was established. Everybody wanted to help the Palestinian Authority, to help the population, and they committed to support it financially. United States committed to pay the Palestinian Authority $500 million for 5 years. They gave the first $100 million, but then when they wanted an audit to know what the was done with the money, Arafat wasn't able to get an accounting, and they stopped. But the European Union, who committed to pay the Palestinian Authority $10 million a month, simply continued. And they knew that Arafat was pocketed the money, and they knew that he's diverting to terrorism, and yet the money was flown into them.
Well, even according to your book, even when the money went to food, medicine, schools, hospitals, that was used in many respects for indoctrinating the public. You talk about there was a kind of a moment where IDF and the Israeli security services realized that there was, that at one point maybe this is about Palestinian nationalism, but it had shifted to become more and more about fundamentalist Islam and about, you know, the kind of the ideas that are expunged by ISIS and others today.
Right. You could have seen suddenly all the mosques are getting built and schools that are teaching extreme Islam and hospital conducted by Muslims. And the whole population was shifted to very radical Islam. And this enabled the terror organizations to work and to use the population either as human shields or as a field to go and carry out attacks among them.
You've already mentioned his name, but the protagonist of this book really is not at the beginning of the book, the former Mossad judge chief, Meir Dagan.
Dagan.
Who at the beginning is an IDF officer, but he's not your normal IDF officer. He was really innovative. He kind of, you'd say, he thought outside the box is the cliche, but he was a military commander that realized that you couldn't keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect different results. It was interesting to see about when he essentially had the leash taken off and sent into Gaza to go after these terrorists. You say in the book there was 850 wanted terrorists when he went in there. And when he left, there were only 9 left. I mean, it's hard to argue that success rate.
He was a tough soldier and center, and he got the permission though. He was able to work; otherwise, he wouldn't able to eliminate all the terrorists. Him and later on, Prime Minister Sharon were inmates in Gaza, and they fought together. And he's known; he was known as with a dagger between his teeth. This is the image of Meir Dagan, but yet he was against wars. Mm-hmm. Yet he could not bear losing life. And when he moved on to Lebanon and had all these fights there, he lost a lot of his friends, a lot of his soldiers. It literally broke his heart. And he came back home after the battles in Lebanon. He told his wife that they are going to become vegetarians because he no longer can bear flesh and meat.
Well, and you see that historically where the ultimate warriors are the ones, you know, that are the most, the biggest peacenecks that really say, you know, if you need me to, I will, but let's try to find another way. And you mentioned that he was one of the earliest people to be sold on the idea of going after terrorist finance. But even someone like him had a hard time convincing others that money was key. You'd think somebody with that kind of background and that kind of military record would be listened to. I mean, he was eventually.
He was in the beginning, right. In the beginning, he was the head of the National Security Council. So he had a job, but it wasn't the ultimate job. And although he convinced Prime Minister Netanyahu to build this unit that will go after terror financing, and Netanyahu agreed, and they created this unit called Harpoon. This is the name of the book. By the way, in Israel, in order to pick up a name in the IDF unit or any military operation, there is a computer that just picks up names. And they picked up Harpoon. It was so unique and so fitting, this unit. When he created this unit, it was supposed to be representatives from the Mossad and the Shin Bet and the IRS and the Treasury in Israel and the Foreign Ministry, and they all came together, and he wanted them to come and find a solution how to go after terror financing. And they objected. It's the midst of the Intifada. Buses are getting blown up in the air. So many suicide bombings. So many people are getting killed. And he's going after money?
Yeah.
But then, in the second Intifada, when he was appointed to be the head of the Mossad, and he was his ally, Ariel Sharon, from...
It helps to have friends in high places. Yeah. I love the story. I love the story of... I guess it's the first meeting of the council, and he's late, and everybody else at the meeting is giving him like the stink eye because he's not supposed to be late. They're all high level generals and everybody else. And he goes to the end of the, can you just pick up the story from there? Because it tells a lot about his personality.
Yeah. There was a high top meeting with the prime minister and all the commanders and all the heads of the security forces in Israel. And Mayor Dagan was late to the meeting. And in the meeting, I could say that, usually everybody wants to sit near the prime minister because this is where the majority of action is going on, and this is the head of the table. So when Mayor Dagan came late into the meeting, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told him, "Hi, Mayor, come on in. Come and sit next to me at the head of the table." And Mayor Dagan said, "Where I sit is the head of the table."
Right, yeah, and that again, it's certainly indicative of how his relationship with Sharon was.
Yes.
I mean, having that person willing to give full support.
He trusted him. Sharon said, "I want someone with a dagger between his teeth. I want a tough commander. I want someone very creative, loseless, in a sense, to run the Mossad."
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a kind of a tough line that Dagan had to track between making sure he wasn't affecting the average Palestinian on the ground who wasn't involved in terrorism, but still going after the money of people like Arafat, because Arafat continued to try to pretend that he was dirt poor, but they were funneling tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into their own pockets and the big houses and everything of the PLO commanders. So you had to make sure, I mean, this is an American, we'll talk about the U.S. coming in, but the American concern always was, how do you take out or bankrupt the leadership without hurting the average Palestinian on the ground?
Right. So in the case of Yasser Arafat, it was quite easy because Yasser Arafat was taking the money to his own coffers. They did not give the money to the population. Indeed, all the support that the donating countries gave the Palestinian Authority was supposed to get to go and build the infrastructure, houses, schools, hospitals. But if you were going into the Palestinian Authority, you could have seen that the people there are living in a dismal state. And when you wonder where the money is going, you would just simply know that it's going to Arafat's pockets. So Ariel Sharon, who did not like Arafat, he refused even to shake his hand, agreed with Mayor Dagan that it's time to separate Arafat from his money. And they launched this operation. They sent Harpoon units to a country in South America, and they built up an investment company, investment fund, and convinced Mohammed Rashid, who was the financial advisor of Yasser Arafat, to come to this country and to learn about this investment and perhaps even invest in it. And they made it very, very attractive. They show him what type of interest he can get, what lucrative return he can get on his money, and even personal benefits that he can get if you invest with him. And Mohammed Rashid, who usually very cautious, left all cautious behind, and started investing in this company. And indeed, he made tremendous return on his money. Didn't pull the money out. He just kept investing more and more funds from Arafat's money until one day the company disappeared along with Arafat's money. It was simply went into a thin air. Mohammed Rashid suspected it was the Israelis who were standing behind it, but he did not have a proof to prove it.
Well, and why in the world would you want to publicize how badly you just got duped by the Mossad and hundreds of millions of dollars?
It was very embarrassing. Later on, we heard that Mohammed Rashid just left the Palestinian Authority, ran to Egypt looking for his life.
Yeah, I'm sure he went very, very quickly after that. How did 9/11 change the dynamic here? Because this is happening, for people to know, the Oslo Agreement is in the 90s. And so there are years after that where you have this terrorism going on significantly in Israel, but the United States is not necessarily paying as much attention as we might otherwise. Then you get 9/11.
Yeah. When terrorism hits you, you understand that you have to fight it, that it's not only an Israeli problem anymore, it's in your home. And whereas it was very hard to convince the American to join this fight against terror financing, the American had their own considerations. As you said before, they didn't want the population to get hit or the financial system or the banking system in these countries to collapse as a result of taking steps against them. After 9/11, it changed. And, there's a story that the Harpoon unit wanted to get the attention of the United States, mainly when it came to Hezbollah. And they told them, they went to the United States, they told them, listen, they thought that maybe they can get attention by saying, which was true, that Hezbollah was counterfeiting the $100 bill, the super bill. And they were literally was sent from a unit to a unit, from an agency to an agency. Nobody wanted to deal with this matter. In the end, they told him to go to the Secret Service because this is the agency that deals with counterfeiting. So Harpoon went to the Secret Service and told them that Hezbollah is counterfeiting $100 bills. And the Secret Service said, how much are counterfeiting? And Harpoon said, as much as $50 million. And the Secret Service said, that's all? So Harpoon said, it's $50 million in the hands of a terror organization.
Right.
Do you know what a terror organization can do with $50 million? And yet they could not get the attraction of the American government.
Well, it was about that time that the Israelis began to set their sights on a really big fish. And in this case, I'm talking about the Arab Bank. And that seems to be the game changer in kind of redirecting a lot of attention behind the finance and going after it, specifically in that case. Because the accounts themselves in the Arab Bank, it was a above-board bank in Jordan that did a lot of legitimate business, but they're able to look and say, there's several accounts in here.
Right.
That there is a A to B direct lineage to terrorist attack.
Absolutely. When Hamas originally was, when Hamas leaders were deported in 1992 to Lebanon, they were adopted by the Iranian Shiites over there, by Hezbollah. And they had great connections with Iran, with Hezbollah. So when they went back into Israel, they got funding from the Iranian government. In addition, the Saudi Arabia government wanted to support the terror organizations in the West Bank, and the Saudi charity was giving a lot of money to the families of the suicide bombers. And Israel, Harpoon, was watching all this and getting enormously frustrated. There are bank accounts in the Arab Bank, in other banks as well, but mainly in the Arab Bank, that millions of dollars are going from Iran into the accounts, from Saudi Arabia into these accounts, and then they're going from these accounts to the Hamas, to the Islamic Jihad, to Sheikh Yassin, who was the head of the Hamas organization, funding terror attacks. So in the beginning, they tried to convince the banks to close down these accounts. But the bank is a Jordanian bank, did not really care, and thought that they're basically immune because there is not much Israel can do against them. And then Harpoon went and met with officials of the banks and bank managers and tried to convince them to close an account, but nobody agreed. So finally, Mayor Dagan said, if it doesn't go by good, it will go by bad, yeah. And raided the banks.
This Operation Green Lantern.
Green Lantern, yeah.
And the money that was seized, I mean, so they raided the banks. The money that was seized was important. But it seems like the intelligence that was gathered during these operations is even more. It basically was the smoking gun showing these accounts that were directed.
Right. In addition to the money that they took, they got a lot of information. They got a lot of documents that were indicating where the money is coming from and where it's going, and to show that the Arab bank was dirt on aiding and abetting terrorism. And this information was given to us, to other lawyers, to go and to try to see if there is something to be done against debt organizations in the legal field, against the state that sponsored them, and against the banks that provide them with financial.
Well, and also it turned out that the way the money was wired from Iran and other places was using Western Union and other kind of organizations. All of a sudden, there's an American connection to all this, too. But even though all this amazing intelligence is gathered, the United States wasn't particularly happy with Operation Green Lantern.
No, they were very angry.
I mean, the State Department was kind of mild, but George W. Bush was apparently furious
about
that. Oh, yes,
was very, very critical. I mean, you take an IDF unit, you come with soldiers and tanks and surround the banks, and then with a gun, you go into the bank and you meet with the bank manager and you're pointing out a gun and telling, listen, come with me to the safe and give me the money that belongs to the terror organization. And I will tell you what money belongs to the terror organization because I have all the papers. And then you pull out the money from the safe and in the end give the bank manager a receipt. So it's
bank
like a
robbery with tanks. Yeah, I can see how it looked that way.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
How important was the Hebrew University suicide bombing or bombing attack as a game changer for the U.S.-Israel relationship when it came to working closer together against these terrorist organizations?
Yeah, they realized that not only the PA, you know, the suicide bombing of the Hebrew University was a major attack that was done by Hamas. And a lot of American victims got killed in the attack. We were filing lawsuits. I hope this is where you're leading. Mm-hmm. Lawsuits against the Palestinian Authority on behalf of the victims of the Hebrew University attack. Not only on behalf of them, on behalf of many, many American citizens that got killed during the Intifada. by attacks that were perpetrated or assisted or done by employees of the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian policemen, Palestinian security guards, officials of the PLO, and all this was brought in a federal district court in the United States. It lightened the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority over these attacks.
It really opened the door for two major U.S. laws to be applied to this. One was the Patriot Act, which most of our listeners will know. I mean, Patriot Act broadens the ability to go, or at least to follow terrorist financing using FISA and other types of electronic surveillance. But even kicking back to a law that was passed in 1992 in response to a lot of the stuff happened in the 80s in Beirut, in Lockerbie, Scotland with Pan Am Flight 103. This 1992 Anti-Terrorism Act, which allowed you to sue even if an attack happened overseas, but if U.S. citizens were hurt, no matter where they were, it opened up the American court system to potential repercussions.
This is the law that we use to bring lawsuits in the United States on behalf of American victims. The law allows only American victims to file this lawsuit. And the lawsuits were brought against the Palestinian Authority, against the Arab Bank, against the National Westminster, against Credit Lyonnais, against UBS, against Lebanese Canadian Bank, American Express Bank, against Bank of China, and you know what? Even recently, against the social media networks, against Facebook, Twitter, and Google, all violating this Anti-Terrorism Act for aiding and abetting terrorism, for providing material support to a designated terror organization, which this law prohibits.
The social media stuff is not in the book, but when I researched you, I saw, like, oh, this is really interesting. And again, I want to talk about that at the end, because that, to me, is kind of a whole new frontier of moving into things. What I love in the book is the first year. So I went into this book cold. I knew a little bit about kind of terrorism financing, but I didn't know your role in this. I thought you're just another author. And then all of a sudden, halfway through the book, you're in it. And you're brought in to work with not only with Mossad, but also work with members of the IDF and with the top security people. They weren't necessarily at open to your assistance. I can't remember who it was, but somebody asked you about, like, what was your end game, to destroy Hezbollah's FICO score, you know, destroy their credit rating. But at the same time, your organization had, I don't want to use the word help, maybe we can use the word help from Mossad, kind of directing you in certain ways.
You know, we were private lawyers when we just started bringing lawsuits against the organizations. It was in the year of 2000, the Intifada, second Intifada broke out. People were getting killed on the street. Blood was spilled on the streets of Jerusalem, of Tel Aviv. And we thought that as lawyers, we can go after what terror organizations need most, money. Money directs everything. Money is the oxygen to the terrorism. And if you stop the flow of the money, you can stop the flow of the terrorism. So we started filing these lawsuits against Iran, against Hamas, against the Palestinian Authority. And after 2 years, we got decisions in our favors. $180 million judgment against the Iranian government. Decision both in Israel and the United States stating that the Palestinian Authority is not a state. They don't have sovereign immunity. You can sue them both in Israel and the United States. A lien that we were able to put on Palestinian money for 64 million shekels, which is an amazing amount of money. And then we were approached by the Harpoon Unit, which we didn't know were Harpoon Unit at that time, that asked us to come and give them a brief of how is it going on, how it happens, how can you bring lawsuits and be effective. So we went to I went to this building in North Tel Aviv, unidentified one, and I entered the room, and there were like three agents sitting there, and I gave them the whole brief, and I told them, this is what we are going to do. We are going to we are suing terror organizations. We are bringing them to court, and we are going to get judgment against them, and in the end, we are going to enforce these judgments. We are going to go after their assets, after their bank accounts, after their real estates. And then there was silence. And one of the agents suddenly raised his head and said, so what you're going to do? Wreck Hezbollah's credit rating?
New ideas sometimes take time before people are willing to embrace them.
In the second meeting that we had with them, they already gave us information and trusted that this is a real way to go after terror funding.
What I love is how quickly trial lawyers and people who do this for a living, whether it's going after tobacco companies or going after insurance companies or everyone with deep, deep pockets, realized after, I guess, 2004, the first case against Arab Bank was brought in New York, and then you had all these fat cat, deep-pocketed trial lawyers saying, ooh,
that's
banks, this is great.
This is
Let's go after this new
area of law. Yeah, we can make a lot of money from it.
I mean, was that something that you thought might be a repercussion of this, to show that this was a lucrative? I mean, you're not in it for the money, clearly. But you had to think, if I can show that I can get these tens if not hundreds of millions of dollar judgments, then all of a sudden other lawyers are going to see this as a potential way of doing business.
Well, yeah, and other lawyers did. The problem was that most of them were there only for the money. Mm-hmm. And then they picked their targets. They decided to go only after the deep pockets. Not only in terms of financial ability, but the way to enforce their judgment. I mean, we were going after countries like Iran, like Syria, that are very deep pockets, but go and enforce a judgment against them. And these lawyers, these tobacco litigation lawyers and all the class action suits lawyers, went into this area just to make a profit. We felt this is not where we want to go. But, the field is open, so everybody can bring this court of lawsuit.
So around the same time, in conjunction with some of these early lawsuits, Dagan convinced the prime minister to, the phrase we use here, kinetically target some actual banks during the war in Lebanon in 2006, which, you think of all the potential targets of the Israeli Air Force, military targets and artillery and missiles and everybody else, but he wanted resources that could have been used to target military units to actually go and bomb banks, which is as novel an idea as you can possibly have. And so they did. They went after banks in Lebanon that were funding Hezbollah.
Yeah, when the war broke out, and it's actually, Israel started bombing Hezbollah targets from the air. They did it because they didn't want to open a ground invasion. They knew that once they send soldiers into Lebanon, there will be death and kills all around the area. Fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon, Israel had very, very bad experience with that. So Prime Minister Olmert tried to find attacks and headquarters of Hezbollah for air missiles strikes. But then he ran out of targets also, because in the end, Hezbollah is a sophisticated organization. They were launching their missiles attacks from underground tunnels and bunkers. They were taking the launcher out and immediately putting it back in. And days were passing by, and there was no choice but to start a ground invasion. So Mayor Dagan came to Olmert and told him that the only way they can bring this war to an end is to eliminate all the cash that Hezbollah had.
This is not like bombing a Wells Fargo down the street where everything's computerized and there's no, like, it's not a lot of money there. This is a cash operation. So if you can physically destroy the dollar bills
Yeah. So he told them, listen, we know where Hezbollah keeps its money, in which branches of the Lebanese banks Hezbollah have their money. Let's bomb them from the air. And Olmert agreed, But the IDF refused. And Halutsu was the chief of staff, said, what are you doing? I mean, you're wasting ammunition on banks it never heard of. But Mayor Dagan insisted, and Olmert agreed. And in the end, they bombed the banks from the air. And they eliminated cash, really cash, that were kept for Hezbollah, and eliminated the bank records of these accounts, which put Hezbollah in a financial crisis, which eventually led to the end of the war in terms of Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire and go into negotiation.
Well, you said they destroyed about $100 million in cash. That can put a hamper on your ability to fight a war.
Well, absolutely.
Well, they even went after bankers themselves, too.
Yes, they wanted to make it personal.
Yeah.
They wanted to know, to tell people that, listen, it's not okay to run accounts for Hezbollah, to provide them financial services. And if you agree to do it, you will be hit. You should know that you are a target. And indeed, the whole a paradigm of Harpoon was that there are no white-collar jobs in the terror organization, that if you provide money to a terror organization, you are part of the terror organization, and you are a target as well, perhaps the highest target of them all.
Mm-hmm. Well, and although this was a very effective strike to end the war, they weren't poor for long, because they certainly have nation-state backers, but also ways of getting money, whether it's from Iran or from narco-trafficking in Venezuela.
Right.
And so one of the next steps was kind of jumped off of something earlier you talked about the South American investment company. But one of the most brilliant Ponzi scheme covert actions, I was just laughing when I was reading this, was you lay it out so well. If you could tell the story a little bit about that, because in the end, it not only had the impact of a financial hit to Hezbollah, but a propaganda and image hit that may have even been more important in the end.
Right. So that's a story about Salah Azzedine, a man, a very rich man from Lebanon that wasn't born so rich. He was born in a very small neighborhood, poor neighborhood in South Lebanon, and decided that he is not going to wind up as his friends. Some of them are in jail, some of them are dead, some of them are terrorists. He will become a wealthy man. And he invested in the real estate and really became a very well-to-do guy. But he was very religious. He came from a very religious family, and he wanted to be identified with the Shiites, with Hezbollah. He made all his way to be very, very close to the leaders of Hezbollah by donating. He gave them gifts. Every birthday of one of the leaders, he was there. He was taking photos. He was every engagement. He was simply supporting the Hezbollah and the Shiite community in Lebanon. And everybody were approaching him, and he had like a huge castle in the middle of Lebanon. So he was a good target because it was closely identified with the leaders of Hezbollah. He even knew where Munir Hania was in every given moment. It was a good target. So Harpoon, no. It wasn't a pun, according to foreign press. One day, this guy, Salah Azzedine, was traveling to Dubai. And over there, he was introduced to young, energetic businessmen. And they told him that they have investment and persuaded him to come and invest with them. Again, they showed him that how lucrative the investment is and what a good return he can get for his money. And he trusted them. They were very, very convincing people. And he started investing with them. He went back to Lebanon, opened his own investment fund, and not only invest his own money, but convinced others to invest with them. he went to the leaders of the Hezbollah organization, and they invested money, and he went to the leaders of the Shiite community, and they invested money, and then a lot of the people saw that you can go and invest and get, like, huge return on the money, so they all trusted him because he was connected to Hezbollah, so everything Hezbollah does must be pro-population. And indeed, the interest went to 40%, and people just kept investing. And the way that he secured the investments of the people is by giving them a check for the amount of their investment. He said, anytime you want to cash out, you can just cash the checks. So one day, one of his investors went and cashed $200,000 check, and the check bounced. So he called Salah Azzedine and told him that the check bounced. And Salah Azzedine said, it's impossible. It's impossible. I have billions of dollars in this account. Nothing bounced. He called the bank, and the bank told him that there is absolutely no money in the account. And he got scared. He called the rest of his banks, and every account was totally emptied out. And then he had a problem. How do you go and show your face or your body near the leaders of Hezbollah after losing all their money? And he tried to hide, and Hezbollah found him and had to give him a trial and everything else, but... But the image now, Hezbollah is looking at all these hundreds of people or thousands of people that invest in all their life earning with this guy, and which closely identifies with Hezbollah. And the image and what the perception can be now, it was a disaster for Hezbollah.
Well, because a lot of the average person in Lebanon who had now been completely cleaned out, because they invested their life savings, could still look back at Hezbollah, who weren't completely cleaned out, still driving luxury cars,
right,
still buying $300 headscarves,
right,
still living in these mansions. And, you know, that's not a good image.
No.
And even talk about in the book, about even media that was pro-Hezbollah, that was very positive towards Hezbollah, because they turned against them and
they
said
called
they were
kind of, the Lebanese Madoff.
And to make it seem too much like the PLO, like how they had been corrupted by money. And I think, you know, in fundamentalist Islam, that's a pretty harsh criticism to put, saying someone had been corrupted by money.
100%. Yeah. You know, the only reason Hamas won the election in 2006 over the PLO is because PLO was corrupt and Hamas was not. So for the population, it's very important to go with a clean party, with someone that doesn't steal your money. So the entire image of Hezbollah totally changed after this Lebanese Madoff affair.
Let me switch gears a little bit and ask you about something that our listeners will understand a bit, because it's kind of part and parcel, a philosophical underpinning of intelligence operations, in that the United States and Israel had a bit of a difference in philosophy concerning the money itself, where the Americans wanted to follow the money and see where it led and try to get to the bigger fish and use it as a trail to get to the high levels. But Israel wanted to lop it off. And anyway, certainly you can understand that, right? To stop the immediate threat. If you can stop them from getting $10 million, you might be able to stop several suicide bombings. Whereas the United States, like you mentioned, the Secret Service saying $50 million, let us know when there's real money there, wanted to follow it further along.
Right, right. And the United States did not have these daily suicide bombings on their streets, did not have these daily terror attacks. So for AIDS, it's a nice operation just to follow the money and maybe then create a huge operation to stop it. But Israel was fighting for its life, so they had to stop the money.
How problematic was this? You kind of talk in the book about it a little bit, of how this kind of difference in philosophy manifested itself. Did this slow down potential partnerships between the two countries, or?
You know, in the end, yes. But in the end, I think that the Israelis convinced the Americans to join in the fight and to take action. I mentioned in the book the operation against SWIFT, how the American went and terminated the ability of Iran to use the SWIFT system that, you know, eliminates their way to transfer money around. How United States agreed to impose sanctions on Iran and convince the rest of the world to join it, because only American sanctions are not so useful. And how America, in the end, used this new frontier, the fight against their financing, for its own fight mm-hmm. against ISIS.
Let me ask you about something. It took me a while to figure out what it meant, but you do a good job in explaining it in the book, because I'm not a banker, I don't know this, but how did correspondent banking arrangements change the game? It seems to me, I was reading it, and I'm like, it's a little bit complicated, but then I got along, I'm like, I better learn a little bit about this, because it seemed to be 100% the game-changing moment once you were able to use that to tie everything back to the United States. Right. American laws seemed to be open to everything at that point.
Right. So specifically, we're talking about the Lebanese Canadian Bank. This was a bank in Lebanon that had all the accounts for Hezbollah, all their foundations and charities that Israel was trying to convince them to close the accounts. But Israel has no influence in Lebanon or over Lebanese Canadian Bank. So they approached the United States because all the transactions of Hezbollah in this bank were done in dollars. And any transaction in dollar must go through a correspondent American bank.
So even though the Lebanese Canadian Bank didn't have a building in downtown New York City, they still had to do work with American
right.
banks in order to do their job.
Absolutely. Because to get money from Iran into Hezbollah, it's only in dollars. And the financial system works, like the banking system works like this, that you must go through an American correspondent bank. The American refused to shut down the ties between the correspondent American banks to the Lebanese banks because they're afraid once again to harm the banking system in Lebanon and to bring it to its collapse. The Lebanese Canadian Bank was a major bank in Lebanon. So Mayor Dagan and the Harpoon Unit asked us if we can file a lawsuit against Lebanese Canadian Bank and against its correspondent American bank, mm-hmm. which was American Express Bank.
Which is does have buildings in the United
States. And we agreed, we gathered many victims from the Second Lebanese War from 2006, Jews, Bedouin, American, Canadian, Israelis, Christians, and filed a major lawsuit against Lebanese Canadian Bank and American Express Bank in New York. And then they both filed motion to dismiss. Lebanese Canadian Bank said that there is no jurisdiction over it. There is no American jurisdiction over the bank because they don't have offices in the United States. They don't operate in the United States. They don't have business in the United States. There is no way for the United States legal system to catch them and litigate against them. And American Express Bank said that as a correspondent bank, they could not know what Lebanese Canadian Bank is doing. They could not know what type of accounts Lebanese Canadian Bank had. Forget about the fact that the accounts were under the name of Martyr Foundation. But that was their argument. And the District Court of New York accepted the motion to dismiss and threw out the lawsuit. We filed an appeal, but the Courts of Appeal decided different. The Courts of Appeal said that because the transactions were done in dollars and because they must have gone through a correspondent American bank, American jurisdiction, there is an American jurisdiction of the bank, American court have the capability of hearing this case. Why? Because there is a long-arm statute in the United States that catches even institutions that are not in the United States but do run business in the United States back into the legal system of the United States. And that caused a huge change because now any bank that, even though it does not have any representation in the United States, can be brought to court in the United States. And as far as it goes to correspondent banks, they became very careful from now on, because there is no, it's not worth their while to take a risk of lawsuits for hundreds of millions of dollars on behalf of their victims that perhaps in the next lawsuit will have a different decision.
It was, I mean, banks weren't doing this because they supported Hezbollah. They're doing it because they made them money. You know, it's if they got a piece of the pie here, but if you make it prohibitively expensive for banks to do business,
for all the fees.
You know what, the money's not worth it.
Absolutely. For all the fees that they're getting, it's not worth it, because nothing will be equal to a judgment for hundreds of millions of dollars. And this is what the courts rule in these sort of cases. And nothing is worth having a judgment condemning you for aiding and abetting terrorism. These have implications. I'm not sure the Congress, American Congress, will let any bank that is adding an event in terrorism to continue operating in the United States.
Well, this judgment actually shut down LCB in 2012. I mean, probably not the intention of the U.S. government, certainly, when they, I guess, the Treasury Department named them as a money laundering organization.
Right.
But, you know,
they designated them as a terror entity and a money laundering institute, which brought the banks to a close down, shut down.
Again, even though the bank was not even in the United States, just that pressure put upon it by people like yourself, lawyers fighting court cases in the Department of the Treasury, all of a sudden there were pariahs in the banking community, and that's all it took.
Yes.
You know. So let me get to that question, what's next? Because you already talked about this idea of going after not just banks, but also social media. For supporting, not supporting,
right?
It's seriously doubt that, you know, the CEOs and people at Facebook and Twitter are like, let's give Hamas a hand today. That's not happening. But the argument you're saying, it doesn't matter.
Yes. Today we are aware of a new form of terrorism. Not so many suicide bombings as lone wolf attacks, stabbing attacks, car ramming attacks, people grabbing a rifle and started shooting towards 58 people in Vegas, and crazy terror attacks like this. And so you can't really go after the financial infrastructure because it's very cheap. That you act alone, not really alone, but we'll get into this, but they go and grab a knife, doesn't cost anything. They rent a car, doesn't cost anything, and carry out and kill pedestrians and kill innocent people. But there is a common thread between all of these attacks, because all these perpetrators, and it was checked and examined and inquired and investigated by all the security services in Israel and the United States and Europe, where these terror attacks were taking place, all these perpetrators are connected to the social media, gets inciting posts to go and carry out attacks. They themselves use the social media and utilize it in their different operations, to the extent that the social media became a tool in the hands of the terror organizations. Hamas, for instance, is using Facebook to recruit militants, to raise funds, to spread their propaganda, to send their messages. ISIS is using the YouTube as a tool to deliver their messages, to send all these beheading videos, to alert people to what they do and encouraging them to go and join them in Iraq and Syria. They all use Twitter to organize this attack and communicate between each other. In the United States, this anti-terrorism act that we talked about prohibit any American company to provide any sort of material support to a designated organization, and impose criminal and civil liability on these companies. So we have lawsuits going on against Twitter, against Facebook, against YouTube for aiding and abetting terrorism, financial lawsuits, billions of dollars in damages, going on in the federal courts in New York and California. And this is the new frontier. There is a very good defense for these social media networks. It's called the Communication Decency Act. This is the law from 1996. It keeps the internet open and grants blanket immunity to these social media networks for the content that they have on their sites. But I believe that once it goes to the courts of appeal or the all the way to the Supreme Court, this paradigm will have to change, and the court will have to choose what has to govern the freedom of speech, which is a very valued asset, against the right of the people to live safely.
I mean, the idea is not to shut down Twitter or Facebook. It's to force them to at least self-govern the stuff that's on their website. I mean, you're already starting to see that a little bit with, you know, hate speech and other things on Twitter, but not necessarily as much as it should be. And they might have to worry a little bit more about that as on Facebook with the whole Russia investigation and how they were able to be bought off to put all that stuff there.
They have the tools to do it. Yeah. They have the algorithm, you know, the same way Facebook knows what type of coffee we drink in the morning. They have the ways, they have the algorithm, and they can monitor these deadly words, these beheading videos, these terrorism posts, and take them down. Because in the end, words can really kill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you see it all the time, you know, inspired by ISIS. Like, that's the kind of the common phrase now is, this person never traveled to Syria, this person didn't have any formal training, this person doesn't have any kind of direct relationships, but they saw some videos.
Right.
Or, you know, the Zinaev brothers in the Boston Marathon, or the guy just, you know, I guess by the time this post a couple weeks ago, who drove the Home Depot truck in New York, you know, all they did was watch stuff online. They, you know, it's, you know, Major Hassan, when he shot up Fort Hood, had a direct line of communication to Anwar al-Awlaki and emailing back and forth. You don't need that anymore.
No.
I mean, you can. It's brought to you now.
And please note that this inspiration is not going through the regular media. You won't see CNN showing again and again beheading videos or New York Times putting an ad of recruiting militants to ISIS. It's only on the social media that think that they are immune. And our goal is to teach them otherwise, to teach them to be accountable and to take responsibility.
Well, good luck to that. You may have other things working for you. I mean, are you looking at the Facebook Russia thing as a potential helper?
Once we pass the motion to dismiss, I guess we'll have Zuckerberg on our witness stand. And other officials from Facebook and other directors from the social media networks, and get them to explain what their policy is, what they did, how they... Because they are getting involved, you know? They're not simple a bulletin board. We know exactly that when they want to get involved in something, they do. They take an approach and they do it. So,
is your conversation going beyond the court system and looking at Congress or...
Yes.
Yeah,
because we're looking into this as well, yes.
Well, good luck with that. But, I think that the more people are informed about this, the more likely it is that there's some kind of movement, because, you know, Congress doesn't act unless they have to.
Right.
And they don't have to unless people are pushing them to. And I think that, you know, whether it's reading this book, which I highly recommend, or if it's kind of just learning more about, you know, the impact of not only social media, but financial systems, you know, the kind of the basis of this book, on the ability of terrorists to do their jobs, for lack of a better term. I think the more people know, the more people are... there seems to be low-hanging fruit solutions to some of this. And it's kind of stupid to, you know, hey, let's go invade another country to stop terrorism. No, let's just prevent some basic, easy stuff to try to work our way to a solution. So the book is called Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. The author is Nitsana Darshan Leitner. Is there anywhere online that people can get more information about your organization and about what you guys do?
Yes. So our website called israellawcenter.org. Or if you Google Shurat HaDin, you can get to it. There is a lot of information. We also have a page for Harpoon itself. And Facebook page and Twitter and everything you just need. And I encourage really people to go on the website and join us in our fight. In the end, it's the Western world against the terror organizations.
Well, it's a fascinating book. I highly recommend it. Natana, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today here on SpyCast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.